Welcome back. This is Terry Cronin from Melbourne, Florida, and as your editor-in-chief, I want to welcome you to this edition of Dialogues in Dermatology for December 2015, Volume 71, Issue 12. This is a multimedia digest prepared by the American Academy of Dermatology. Remember to download the fabulous new Dialogues in Dermatology app for your smartphone and computer. This convenient app is improving the Dialogues experience while effectively providing CMEs for you. In this month's edition, we have three new dialogues. It is an exciting and potentially overwhelming time to be a dermatologist, thanks to a rapidly increasing and complex armamentarium of systemic agents for dermatologic use. There are more options than ever before, but knowing when and how to use each medication requires careful study. In this dialogue, Dr. Todd E. Schlesinger and Dr. Mark Jackson give an overview on systemic agents in dermatology.
Welcome to Dialogues in Dermatology. I'm Dr. Todd Schlesinger, dermatologist in Charleston, South Carolina, and on the editorial board of the Dialogues in Dermatology, and I have the pleasure of having Dr. Mark Jackson here, who is a clinical professor of medicine and dermatology at the University of Louisville and a recognized expert in systemic dermatology. And today, we're excited to talk about some of the developments in systemic dermatology, some of the drugs that have been around for a while, and also some of the new medications that are out and how we can reduce those to clinical practice the best way. So I think that what we'll do today is we'll go through a list of different things that have been discussed recently. And the first topic is always retinoids. So retinoids, a big topic. Indications, isotretinoin, acetretinoin. I would start with isotretinoin. What do we need to know nowadays?
I think the thing with isotretinoin that's really important is that it's such a valuable agent for us as dermatologists. And it's really the only true cure that we have for acne. And it makes a huge impact on people's lives. So it does come with some baggage. Some of those are side effects that are based on its mechanism. And some of those are ones that we need to be concerned about. But I think it's more important that we make patients aware of these potential side effects, but not necessarily afraid of them. And I think it's important that we as dermatologists utilize this medicine for our patients. I think the issue with isotretinoin that obviously concerns most people is the teratogenicity related to the medicine, but that's obviously something that we can work to avoid, encouraging patients to be on both forms of birth control, or obviously abstinence is the best method. And besides that, I think the side effects that most people are really bothered by are the dryness and the keelitis and sometimes the asteatotic eczematous eruption that can occur when their doses are really high. And I think it's important that we know as dermatologists that we can titrate the dosage to allow for tolerability of the side effects, knowing that the real goal is to accomplish that cumulative dose. It's not necessarily how fast you do that. It's that you accomplish that goal.
That's how I think of it as well. It's how much drug they get totally. So laboratory monitoring is always a question that I have, and I think other clinicians may have as well. Everybody does something different, it seems like. So what is your feeling about how we should be following, besides the things we know about, like lipids and pregnancy tests? Do you do the same thing every month? Do you change it every month?
I like to do a baseline laboratory evaluation to know what is going on with the patients before I start them on a systemic therapy like isotretinoin or many of the therapies we'll discuss today. It's not necessarily that I'm worried that the medicine may cause a problem with something. It's that I like to know what's going on with their health before we start. So I like to perform a baseline lipid panel. I like to perform baseline liver functions, because if those are high at the beginning, you would want to know that. And if you didn't check at the beginning and found that they were high after you started therapy, you wouldn't know what you were comparing to. So I like to have that baseline in my chart, and I think it's really helpful for the future as well. And so I perform a baseline lipid panel. I perform baseline LFTs. In women who I'm placing on medicine, I like to check their CBC to make sure they're not anemic or looks like they have heavy menses or some other problem that we might need to address before we start isotretinoin. So I like to do that. And then I usually check them at about the second month to see what the trends are. And if I see anything unusual at that point, then we'll either adjust the medicine or repeat the labs. Rarely, if you dose correctly, do you really have to go on antihyperlipidemics and things like that. I think a real important pearl is that the elevated LFTs that many people see when you see in your patients on Accutane, many of those are actually are related to these young active people who actually have a little breakdown of their muscles because of their exercise routine. And it's really not truly liver irritation, but more the CK enzymes and the muscle enzymes. So it's really not related to the medicine. It's related to their activity. So I think that's an important pearl when you're looking at the lab work.
It makes a lot of sense. So how high can you go dosing-wise? So we know we want to get a certain amount of drug in over a certain amount of time, whether the time is longer or shorter. Based on weight, how high do you go? Do you go above, you know, the standard 1 mg/kg dosing? How high do you go?
I really try to hit a target of 120 to 130 milligrams cumulative dosing. And if a patient is not clear at that point but improving, I'll go longer. I do think that people who have a lot more inflammatory acne and those that have it on the chest and back may need a little bit more medicine than some. And then sometimes you do find with that 120 to 130 milligram dosing. But I think in order to get the long-term results, I encourage my patients to complete the course to hit that target dose to prevent the need to return to therapy in the future.
Makes sense. Acitretin, another maybe a little scary medicine for some of the newer folks coming out. I certainly have seen my share of side effects with acitretin, been concerned about using it, but you know it still can be valuable. How are you employing it?
I think it's a great medicine for certain diseases, and then it's a nice addition for others. And I think acitretin is great for pustular dermatosis of the palms and soles, works very well for pustular psoriasis. It works very well for, as I call a condition, psoriasiform dermatitis. It's a little bit of psoriasis and a little bit of dermatitis. And clinically, it looks very much like both, and I think it works very well for that. I use it a lot in combination with narrowband UV light in those patients, and I think it has a lot of utility there.
That's great. And dosing still starting at 25 milligrams, going to 50, you know, the standard that we're used to?
Again, I do it a little bit differently. Most of the time when patients are starting acitretin, you're treating something that's a long-term condition. And it's more important that you get them to tolerate the medicine and get better versus start too high with this medicine and give them the side effects where they lose their confidence. Certain medicines, I think you do have to start high and come down. This is one that I think you need to start slow and increase based on tolerability. And I like to start at 25 milligrams. I dose it every other day for the first 6 weeks or so and see how they do. Women especially are concerned about hair loss, and so I try to go slow to see how they tolerate it. And after they're doing fine at every other day, I'll oftentimes move it up to once a day, and then maybe one pill one day and two on the next. And a kind of a way that patients can remember that is maybe they can take one on the odd days of the month and two on the even days, so they don't get confused at what they're supposed to do on a day. But I think that's a way you can do it. And there are also multiple doses. There's a 10 milligram dose, and there's some doses in between 10 and 25 that are also able to be utilized if you want to go with a more daily dosing regimen, but just less medicine.
Is there an endpoint? Length of therapy?
Acitretin is one of those medicines that people are on for a long period of time. And I think if it's an acute pustular psoriasis flare, you may see that it's used as a short-term agent there. But for the most part, patients are on this medicine for a long period of time. And that takes us back to managing and watching the labbed abnormalities that can occur, the hyperlipidemia and elevated LFTs that can occur. I think those things are important to monitor, but also letting people know that alopecia can occur and the dryness and the tacky sensation on the skin that many times bothers people because you're normalizing keratinization. They feel like their hands or skin feels sticky, and so it's just important to let them know that those things can occur.
It's interesting. And when do you convert them to a biologic? When is it time to move on?
I think the use of acitretin in patients with psoriasis really is something that we used to do. And I think it's something that it's a great medicine, but based on the agents that we have available, it's not a first-line agent for typical psoriasis. Pustular, yes, but the standard psoriasis, I think we have a lot of new agents that are better and better tolerated and require less monitoring and things like that. So I usually don't start with acitretin as a first-line agent, but it's something that you might be able to add, or in a patient who has a history of cancer or is not able to take TNFs or the newer IL-12 and 23 or now the IL-17 inhibitors for some reason. I think it fills a niche there, but it's not my first-line agent for psoriasis.
And when are they going to see side effects? Is it going to be something they're going to see right away in some patients and some delayed? When can you tell your patients to expect the unexpected?
Well, I think that depends on how you dose them. And if you want them to see side effects, you could give them 2 or 3 pills a day and they'd see side effects pretty quickly. So I start low and go slow, as we were talking about. And I usually would notice adverse effects or bothersome effects by 5 or 6 weeks. And that's one of the things that's nice, is that they don't have those come on acutely. They can kind of have them come on subtly, and they're prepared and they're not afraid.
Omalizumab, Xolair. Chronic idiopathic urticaria, new indication in March of 2014. Interesting drug. I don't know how many dermatologists are using that drug yet, but it's certainly becoming more popular. My question with that drug, the indication is it's designed for chronic idiopathic urticaria in patients that cannot be treated with an H1 antihistamine. What's the clinical scenario where you employ that medicine in your practice?
Well, thank goodness it's rare, but I do take care of a lot of patients who have long-term problem with chronic idiopathic urticaria, unresponsive to antihistamines or mildly responsive, and those patients can be miserable. And steroids are effective, but we try to avoid those as much as possible because they have their own issues over the long period of time. I do think that dapsone occasionally has some utility in methotrexate and cyclosporine in patients with urticaria, but obviously they come with their own issues and not everyone is responsive to that. So I would like omalizumab or Xolair in a patient who is on antihistamines, still not adequately controlled, not able to take those other agents or not responsive to those other agents. And I think it has nice utility there, and especially as something to prevent steroid use in patients with long-term urticaria.
It's an interesting drug, and I see we're doing a lot more with it. How do we deal with the side effects? So the package insert talks a lot about anaphylaxis and the concern that you need to be prepared to deal with that kind of patient. Have you seen it? How should we be prepared to deal with that complication in our practice? We're going to observe them, whatnot. What should we be looking for? And how should we be ready for it?
It's a great question. So it is in the package insert. It's something that the patients are concerned about, and I think it's been something that might impede use a little bit of an agent that is really good. But I think the reality is that is really not a common occurrence to have these anaphylactic reactions, and that it's something that we will see infrequently, if at all. But obviously it happened in trials, and so it's something we need to be aware of. So you administer the drug to the patient in the office, and after their injection, you let them sit for an hour or two and just make sure everything's fine, and then you can let them go. Most people who are going to be administering omalizumab will probably have some type of respiratory support, an epinephrine pen. Some people have an AED or automatic external defibrillator in their office, but the need for that would be exceedingly rare.
So before you arrive at the diagnosis of chronic idiopathic urticaria, can you just give me an idea of what the workup is that you like? I mean, are you checking food panels? Are you doing RAS testing, autoimmune testing? How much workup is involved in your mind before you're going to say, they have chronic idiopathic urticaria, we're going to go ahead and treat?
It's a great question, and I don't think we have a magic answer, but I think that there are some things that are helpful. I would say that most of the time, by the time I see the patient, they bring in their lab work and all the things that they have done in advance of seeing me, and that includes allergy testing, either skin and true allergy testing or patch testing. They've taken 7 different antihistamines and including cimetidine and ranitidine and the other H1, H2 antagonists. So usually they come in with that workup. But if it was just a new patient that had had urticaria that was resistant to therapy and I was not seeing them respond and it looked like it was more of a chronic course, I like to just make sure that the routine labs are fine. And I routinely check a CBC, a comprehensive chemistry panel. You could evaluate the liver with that, or you could do a hepatitis panel. I don't usually do that routinely. I think a thyroid panel is sometimes helpful. But beyond that, I don't tend to do a whole lot of workup because the yield tends to be low, and we tend to find a lot of things that we were not looking for that we then have to chase. And most of the time, those patients have urticaria, and we don't know why, and we need to focus on treatment. And I try to counsel patients that let's be less worried about why, but let's get you better, and then maybe we can start identifying triggers.
Any final tips with that one?
I think the patients who have chronic urticaria really have an agenda that they want to discuss with you. And so it's important that you listen to them, but then you also take a little bit of the control. Otherwise, you'll be in the room and chasing down different pathways that are really not something that's going to create a great yield, and that really your focus needs to be on treatment, because if they haven't figured out a cause, if they've had the condition for 3 or 4 years, you're probably not going to do it in the next 10 or 15 or 30 minutes, whatever your office visit takes. And so I try to tell patients we're going to work on getting them better, and we have some nice options available to do that. And that tends to ease their mind, and I think gives them some comfort.
Very good. So let's move on to our next topic, TNF-alpha inhibitors and the IL-12 and 23 agents. So it's a broad topic here. So there's a lot of new medicines on the market, a lot of new research going on. Psoriasis is a very hot topic. So boiling it down to the clinical practice, drugs that we have available now and emerging drugs, what's going on that field?
It's an exciting time to be a dermatologist. And psoriasis is a pathway that has allowed a lot of companies to bring new agents to us and to the market. And it used to be that they had to be studied in another condition before we saw them in dermatology. And now we're seeing that agents are being developed specifically for dermatology, specifically for certain indications that we treat, which is really encouraging and it makes it exciting. I think the TNF-alpha inhibitors were a huge, huge benefit to our patients with psoriasis when they first came to market. And I remember when people would say, well, I really need to see the safety over 10, 15, or 20 years to know that these agents are going to be okay. Well, now we're there, and they've been out that long, and we've had good clinical practice with those. And I think they have a huge benefit to our patients with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis and have been invaluable. In fact, new TNF-alpha inhibitors are continuing to come to the market because of their utility. So that's been great. And now we have these new agents that are approved for psoriasis that have even more efficacy than what we've seen with some of the TNF-alpha inhibitors. So it's an exciting time.
It's hard to believe that we're talking about PASI 90 and PASI 100. Wow. One of the new medications that comes to mind, secukinumab, IL-17. So that one's approved, right, as under the trade name Cosentyx. Tell me how you're using it in practice. It's relatively new, so how are you using it now?
This is one of those medicines that when you talk about a PASI 100 or total clearance, it's something that we couldn't even imagine years ago. And we're talking about PASI 100 scores in a third or more of patients. And it's not that that takes a year to occur. We see that in some patients as soon as a month, which is amazing in a patient that's had something for 20 to 25 years. And we're going to see two more come to the market in the next couple of years. So it's great. It's fun to have a crowded market for this condition that's been so bothersome with our patients. I think that secukinumab will have a lot of utility in our patients who've had psoriasis and maybe arthritis in the future. There's new data that says that it might have some utility in psoriatic arthritis as well. We know the TNF-alpha inhibitors have been the mainstay for psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, but if we find that the IL-17s have equal efficacy for psoriatic arthritis and greater efficacy for psoriasis, they may become our first-line agents and probably will be in the future.
Dr. Jackson, I'd like you to talk about dosing, because secukinumab has a little bit of an unusual dosing scheme. It's different than we're used to. And then when it was approved with multiple doses, which is a little bit unusual. So we have the 150, we have the 300. The data show that the 300 is the most effective, but some people may want to choose a lower dose, and you have that option. So how are you employing that in your practice?
I think it's great that we have the choice to actually practice medicine, and we're not being told what we have to do. We are the ones that need to decide what's best for our patients, and the clinical trials, I think, give us good information to tell us that the 150 milligram dosing in some patients is fine. Some patients need the 300 milligram dosing, and it's nice to have that option to do what's best for your patient. I do think the 300 milligram dosing demonstrates greater efficacy. But in the clinical trials that we actually performed in our office, we still saw great efficacy with the 150 milligram dosing, and I still have people on that dose now.
So, Dr. Jackson, I'd love you to talk about dosing. So, since secukinumab is relatively new, how are you dosing it in your practice?
Secukinumab comes as a 150 milligram subcutaneous injection, and the first injection could be 150 milligrams or 300 milligrams. If 300, it's given as two injections at week 0, 1, 2, 3 and 4, and then Q4 weeks thereafter. So you have a loading dose of 300 milligrams for 5 weeks, and then a 300 milligram dosing or 150, whatever the clinician decides, every 4 weeks.
It's pretty amazing. So one of the things that's been talked about a little bit is the fact that we might in the future be able to look at blood levels of drugs and then assess our patient's response to the medication based on the levels. It's kind of new for dermatology. Of course, in infectious diseases, you know, they're comfortable monitoring vancomycin levels and other drug levels and thinking more about pharmacokinetics. How do you think that's going to play out in dermatology with especially secukinumab?
I think this is where medicines will be in the future. And I think that we will have to know who will receive benefit from medicines before we're able to get approval. When you have a crowded market and you have lots of agents that have effect and great efficacy, we're going to have to know which agent is best for particular patients. And so I think in the future, these blood levels will be monitored. We might see markers that are indicators of response in certain patients. And I think that will then become our monitoring guideline for these medicines in order to determine who gets what. And I think that will be not just in dermatology, but in all specialties when new medicines, especially these systemic biologic agents, come to the market.
I think one more thing in this category, there was an interesting concept that's been talked about called the number needed to treat. So what I got from that is how many patients do you need to give the medication to before you start seeing a response? And it seemed like the numbers were floating in the fours and fives for the older medications and then dropping into the ones and twos. Me, that seems like I'm going to hit a home run with these drugs every time I use them.
It's really exciting. And when you think that your chances of getting a patient better in the 80 to 90% range, you can feel very confident when you're offering these therapeutic agents to patients that they're going to have benefit. And then usually in the past or with certain medicines that have high efficacy, it's sacrificed by high toxicity or tolerability issues. But that's not what we're seeing here. We're seeing numbers of significant efficacy with great tolerability. And again, it makes it fun to be a dermatologist taking care of patients with psoriasis.
We have a lot to look forward to. Apremilast and IL-17, that category is also, apremilast now approved by the FDA for the treatment of psoriasis as well. How's that being used in clinical practice?
Apremilast is an interesting molecule. So it's a small molecule, and small molecules can be taken by mouth. As in contrast to biologic agents or many of the agents that we use need to be injected because the proteins are so large that there's no absorption when taken orally. Apremilast is a small molecule that works via an intracellular mechanism inhibiting phosphodiesterase 4. And this is an intracellular mediator of inflammation. And by inhibiting phosphodiesterase 4, you reduce the inflammation in the tissues. It's a little less specific in its mechanism than we see with the IL-17 inhibitors, but it has nice utility in patients with psoriasis, and it's demonstrated efficacy in patients with psoriatic arthritis as well. I see this as an agent that fits a niche, maybe as a replacement to methotrexate, maybe as an agent that you can add to other agents because of its mechanism, and something that might work for other conditions beyond psoriasis. And it's being evaluated for atopic dermatitis. We might find that it's also helpful in some of these other inflammatory conditions that we don't have things to treat, such as lupus, lichen planus, other inflammatory conditions on the skin. It's nice because it's an oral agent. It's administered twice a day. It does have some potential side effects at the beginning with a little bit of nausea in some patients, maybe headache, maybe weight loss or fatigue. Generally, those are transient and resolve over the first 2 to 4 weeks. And patients who get over that tend to remain free of symptoms after that.
I think this has been a very, very good talk about what doctors can use in clinical practice, the pearls they can take away with all these systemic medications, certainly what we're going to be looking for in the future. Any final practice tips that you would offer a physician, either starting practice or in clinical practice, that may not be familiar with some of these medicines? Where can they go for more learning, more resources?
I think it's important for us as dermatologists to realize that we are physicians, and it's important for us to offer appropriate therapies to our patients, and that with these new agents available, it's important that we know how to use them, and if we don't, to get our patients to people who do in order for them to have the best outcome.
I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us on Dialyzing Dermatology, and I look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thanks, Todd, for having me.
Retinoids are a long-established class of medication employed in many conditions, but are most commonly used in the treatment of acne. Retinoids act on nuclear hormone receptors and affect cellular growth and differentiation, and alter cell cohesiveness. Isotretinoin holds a unique place as a potentially curative agent for acne through its irreversible reduction of sebocytes and sebum production. Recent guidelines have called for the more judicious use of antibiotics due to an observed increase in antibiotic resistance, perhaps further encouraging the use of isotretinoin. Most patients experience dose-dependent mild side effects, including xerosis, cheilitis, and photosensitivity. The most serious side effect, teratogenicity, requires careful discussion with female patients. Although evidence for suicidality or depression is lacking, dermatologists must discuss these concerns with patients as well. Acitretin is also a systemic retinoid and works similarly to isotretinoin. It is of utmost importance in treating pustulosis of the palms and soles, but has demonstrated efficacy in other pustular and keratinizing disorders, including psoriasis, lichen planus, Grover's disease, and Derrière's disease. In the presence of alcohol, acitretin is converted to etretinate, a retinoid with a half-life of 120 days. Thus, it should be avoided in any woman of childbearing age. It is associated with a feeling of sticky skin and alopecia and is more strongly associated with hypertriglyceridemia and drug-induced hepatitis than isotretinoin. Although acitretin is effective for psoriasis, it is not first-line therapy. With the introduction of two novel agents, apremilast and secukinumab, the expectations for safe and efficacious psoriasis treatment continue to rise. Apremilast is an orally available small molecule which specifically inhibits the activity of phosphodiesterase 4, an isoform found predominantly in immune cells. By inhibiting phosphodiesterase 4-mediated breakdown of CAMP, apremilast works intracellularly to downregulate inflammatory mediators. Apremilast efficacy for psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis is lower than for the anti-TNF-alpha agents. The side effect profile includes gastrointestinal symptoms, headache, depression, and weight loss. Generally, the side effects are transient and improve after the first month of treatment. Apremilast does not require any laboratory monitoring and is not contraindicated in patients with serious comorbid conditions, though it requires dose adjustment in patients with renal impairment. Secukinumab is a recombinant high-affinity fully human IgG monoclonal antibody that selectively binds and neutralizes interleukin-17A. Interleukin-17A is the primary effector of Th17 cells, and in psoriatic lesions, it stimulates keratinocytes to recruit additional inflammatory cells. Secukinumab has a loading dose of 300 mg subcutaneously weekly for 5 weeks, followed by monthly dosing at either 300 mg or 150 mg. Secukinumab has demonstrated incredible efficacy for psoriasis, with a PASI 75 greater than 80. It has a favorable side effect profile limited to non-life-threatening infections, including nasopharyngitis, URI, and candidiasis. Although post-marketing surveillance is ongoing in pooled analysis, it has not been linked to any increased incidence of malignancy. Recently, two of dermatology's most bedeviling diagnoses, chronic idiopathic urticaria and hidradenitis suppurativa, have gained FDA-approved treatments. Omalizumab, first approved in 2003 for treating moderate to severe allergic asthma, received an additional FDA indication for the treatment of chronic idiopathic urticaria in 2014. Omalizumab is a humanized IgG1 monoclonal antibody that binds to free-circulating IgE and inhibits its binding to the FCE receptor on mast cells and basophils. Anaphylaxis is reported in approximately 1 in 1,000 patients, and it should be administered in a medical setting. In September 2015, adalimumab garnered FDA approval for moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa. For the hidradenitis indication, adalimumab requires an aggressive loading schedule in the first month, followed by weekly 40 mg dosing thereafter. Dermatologists can now offer these effective systemic medications to their patients, or be knowledgeable enough to refer to a colleague who is prepared to use them. In so doing, we can continue to give our patients the most advanced and best care available.